The next argued case this morning is number 22-1595, Genentech Incorporated against Sandoz Incorporated.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Sandoz has cited no case in which a court refused to find infringement in an ANDA case where the label instructs a physician to infringe, as is the case here. And let me begin with the DDI patents.
Well, Ms. Dury, even if you're right that something in the label amounts to inducement, aren't these patents invalid as being obvious? They claim a dose for an old drug, and lowering the dose if side effects are noticed. Isn't that sort of medication 101? If you have a headache and ask me what to do, I say, take two aspirin, and then you come back and you say, I get a bellyache, and I say, well, lower the dose. Isn't that standard practice?
With respect to the DDI patents, the drug-drug interaction patents, the district court found those patents to be not obvious and found that it was not obvious that there would be a drug-drug interaction through the concomitant use of fluvoxamine and pirfenidone, and that the claims at issue here, which would be either to discontinue fluvoxamine...
Like I were talking about the LFT patents. I think you were saying if a may use language is in the package circular, that amounts to inducement, and I'm saying maybe you're right, but those patents are invalid.
With respect to the LFT patents, the liver function test patents, the court did find those patents to be invalid as obvious. We think the district court misread the prior art in so finding, because the prior art did not identify any instance in which a patient presenting with indications of abnormal liver function, which potentially could lead to very serious liver injury and even the need for a liver transplant, would still be prescribed the drug that was presumptively causing that incipient liver failure, rather than having that drug be discontinued. And we think the patent examiner correctly concluded, reviewing that same prior art, that the prior art taught away from the invention by saying in straight terms that the drug should be discontinued. Having said that, I wanted to focus my argument in the first instance on the DDI patents, because with respect to those patents, there is only one issue for the court to resolve. And that is the question of direct infringement. And there, I would suggest that Sandoz has not cited any case where a court has found where there is a clear instruction in the label to infringe, that there is nevertheless no direct infringement. And that is because under this court's precedence, that analysis of hypothetical infringement takes place with respect to the language of the label, where the language of
Well, you're right, it's with the label, and so maybe every different labels carry different weight with regard to the question you're posing. But in this particular, let's look at the 383, claim 6. We're talking about a method, there's so many claims in this case that I may have the wrong one. But this seems like what I call an if claim. If you're doing something, stop doing it. So why is it not fair, correct, under Hatch-Waxman and maybe any other regime, that if there's an if claim, so it may never happen, that, now I don't want to get into a burden argument, because maybe it's the case that you've satisfied your burden because they're using the claim language and the label. But the district court said here, there was evidence, overwhelming evidence on one side, nothing on the other, that nobody ever did this. So why in this, we're not talking about globally with respect to every claim and what it might require. Right. We're talking about this particular type of claim, and why, if it's kind of what I call, as I said, an if claim, to repeat myself, why it shouldn't, whether it's their burden or your burden, Clearly, whoever had the burden, their evidence was overwhelming, and we're deferring to the district court's fact-finding.
So it is an if claim in the sense that the claim is addressed to a situation where a patient is on fluvoxamine. And if a patient is on fluvoxamine, what do you then do? You either discontinue the fluvoxamine or you reduce the dose of the pirfenidone. The district court did not find that there are no patients that take fluvoxamine. And in fact, there was evidence in the record that it's widely prescribed. The district court did look outside the label to conclude that in his assessment of the evidence, a physician confronted with a patient who was taking fluvoxamine would prescribe a different drug rather than discontinue fluvoxamine. Now, we think that factual finding would be clear error, but we also don't think the court should get to that question because the language of the label is dispositive. And that is what follows from Sanovion. I think in its response to Genentech's 28J letter, I think Sandoz agreed that if we were looking at a product claim, it would be error to look outside the label to determine whether there would be infringement in the real world. And that's because in Sanovion, the ANDA applicant came forward and said, notwithstanding the product specifications, here is conclusive evidence that our product never will infringe. There will never be direct infringement. And this court said, that doesn't matter because the ANDA applicant is stuck with the representations that they made in order to get the patent, and in order to get the product on the market. And said that what a generic applicant asks for and receives approval to market, if within the scope of a valid claim, is an infringement. Now, it is true that in Sanovion, the claim at issue was a product claim.
Right, and I'm suggesting there might be a difference. Okay, even assuming that if you're talking about a tablet formulation that meets the claims, and the label might resolve the dispute. But on the other hand, if the label requires some factual predicate, here a rare disease patient also being prescribed another specific drug, then the label might be enough on its own in the absence of other evidence, but it might not be in light of evidence that the factual predicate wouldn't occur. Why is what I said wrong, and so what case says that what I'm saying is wrong?
I think I have two responses to that, Your Honor. My first response is that I think Par Pharma and this court's 2020 decision in Par Pharma indicates that that is wrong, at least in part, because Par Pharma had method claims as well as product claims and didn't distinguish in its analysis. So I would say as a threshold matter, the Sanovion rule is not limited to product cases, it was applied to method cases in Par Pharma. And then I would say, more generally, if there were some basis to say that the if condition never could happen, maybe we would be in a different situation. But here, where the ANDA applicant has requested permission to give physicians that instruction, if it thinks it is an instruction that doesn't need to be given, the correct audience for that argument is the FDA. Not this court after the fact in an effort to suggest that there was no need to have given the instruction in the first place. And I think that is what comes out of Sanovion, that the policy rationale that underlies this court's decision in Sanovion, 271E infringement has been sort of set up statutorily to be a narrow argument. And the basis for this court's conclusion in Sanovion was that this sort of real-world inquiry into what the hypothetical infringement would be would unnecessarily defer and complicate resolution of this infringement issue that the Hatch-Waxman framework was intended to address earlier. I would also say, Your Honor, this Court's precedent in Vanda makes clear that even in a situation where there is an if condition, and obviously there was this sort of if, are you going to genotype or not, as a predicate to administering the therapy, there, the court said unambiguously, there's no requirement to prove any instance of past infringement. There's no, and this court in affirming, and there's no particular quantum of infringement that is required. And this court in affirming the district court's judgment in Vanda did not attempt to parse the claim construction issues that would have gone to the question whether past infringement in fact had occurred. and did not attempt to evaluate the court's weighing of the evidence. And notably, the district court indicated there were reasons to think this would never happen, that in practice, physicians would not genotype. But this court did not wade into that question and instead simply said the district court's analysis of the label was proper under this court's precedence. And so...
Can I just ask you, this is just not a substantive question, but you, since the case you've been citing repeatedly here is Synovian, and I just checked, and it was Passam and Gray, but I don't see it in cited, I don't think Red engaged in it. I might be entirely wrong on this. I've got too many cases this week. But I don't think Red engaged, and then that raised my question of, well, did you cite it in Blue? And I don't see it in the table of contents in Blue.
I don't believe this particular case was cited in the Blue brief, but certainly the argument has consistently been made, and we relied heavily on Vanda for these purposes. But I think the thesis of the argument is the same, that it is the label that controls the analysis.
So does Synovian give you anything more than Vanda does in terms of your arguments? I'm just trying to put it together now because I've got a lot of paper.
I think Synovian makes it even more clear. I think Vanda makes clear.
Okay, well, I'll ask the other side. Obviously, is entitled to an opportunity to respond to that.
Of course, but let me try to explain how I think the two decisions relate to each other. And I think Par Pharma is sort of yet another in this string. I think Vanda makes it clear that the ANDA controls, and that's obviously in the context of a method claim. But the argument has been made that Vanda does not control because in Vanda the district court did discuss evidence outside the label, mm-hmm. although in our reading of this court's Vanda opinion, that was not required for this court's affirmance. Synovian makes the point that our reading of Vanda we think is correct, and that there are circumstances where the label language itself is dispositive and simply ends the inquiry. I would also note that the Red Brief and Sandoz had cited other cases that are distinguished in the Synovian opinion because they are cases in which the label was broad enough to encompass the possibility of infringement, but did not itself specify that infringement would occur. In those cases, the court has looked to evidence outside the label in order to determine whether infringement in fact will occur. But Synovian makes clear that that inquiry is not appropriate where the label itself disposes of the infringement question by calling for infringement within its four corners. And that's why we think that the Synovian and Par Pharma line of cases are those that should control here.
All right, let's hear from the other side.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Double time. Mr. Jay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. As my friend did, I'll like to focus on the DDI patents and respond in particular to the reliance on this Synovian line of cases, which we think, I think your colleague, Judge Prost, with my friend brought this out, where the ANDA, what the ANDA controls is what's in the generic product. And Synovian says specifically, right, that where it defines a compound, the ANDA defines the compound. That echoes what the court also said in Ferring and in Vanda itself, right, that where the ANDA defines the proposed generic product. We're not disagreeing with the proposition that where the ANDA defines the proposed generic product and then making, using, or selling that generic product would infringe a claim, that's dispositive if the ANDA answers the infringement question. Now, my friend on the other side said that Par, now there are two Par cases, there's the recent one and there's the 2021, but relying on the unpublished 2021 for the proposition that this also applies to method claims. But if you look at the method claim in that case, it is simply administer the compound, administer the claimed compound. So as you'll see, the opinion goes through, why is there not infringement? It's because the compound doesn't infringe. And
with respect to the DDI patents, the court found that these were not infringed, that there was no evidence that these two compounds were administered together. You're asserting that's correct? And since there's no direct infringement, there could be no inducement.
That is exactly our argument, that there's no clear error in that finding.
And is it also your view that the filing of the ANDA provides jurisdiction only for the conduct of the lawsuit rather than serving as the predicate for an inducement finding.
That's exactly right. You can't prove inducement without proving direct infringement, and the burden is always on the plaintiff to establish that if the ANDA was approved and the product was marketed, that infringement would result. In an inducement case, that includes direct infringement, and you can't from the label just presume conclusively that out there in the real world, the if part of an if claim is going to be satisfied.
Well, the reason, I guess you and I may part company, I don't know. But it seems to me you don't really need to answer the burden question in this case, because I can't recall, but I don't think the district court relied heavily or whatever.
Right.
I mean, and here the evidence was one-sided. So I was going to ask, my question to you is hypothetically, if you had put on all your three experts and they had said what they said, and it's very persuasive, and they come in and they have one doctor, one expert that says, yes, I've done this, and yes, I believe it will be done in the future based on my 50 years experience, would that be sufficient?
That's a question for the fact finder. So it certainly could be. And that is what I take the lesson of all these cases to be, that whether direct infringement has been proved as an element of induced infringement is a factual question for the fact finder.
Is that so? Isn't it really a Hatch-Waxman question to get into, to achieve jurisdiction under Hatch-Waxman when everyone knows that there is an actual infringement, no matter how it's construed? You have to have a premise, not as a question of fact, but as a jurisdictional premise of infringement.
Respectfully, Your Honor, infringement is not the jurisdictional premise of a Hatch-Waxman filing. The filing of the ANDA with the Paragraph 4 certification is the artificial act. But one of the things the part of Paragraph 4 certification can say is we certify that we don't infringe the Orange Book listed patent. So you don't concede infringement by filing the certification. And in any event, whether infringement would result following marketing, that's always the question. Now, my friend relied on...
I don't think that that's how it works. You have to have a live controversy for federal jurisdiction. There is a statutory presumption under certain circumstances. You're telling us, don't bother me with circumstances. Those are questions of fact.
I'm saying, Your Honor, that the certification, this court has said in all of its cases, Ferring, Sanovion, Vanda, and Glaxo, I think, is the first of this line of cases, that the filing of the ANDA doesn't allow you to conclusively presume, nor does it concede on the part of the generic, that infringement, whether induced or direct, would
result.
That's
not my understanding of Hatch-Waxman. I'll double-check that understanding. But all these years that it has been working, it seems to me that parties in your position have felt that they were compelled to concede infringement in order to have jurisdiction that artificial infringement can be challenged. You say there is no artificial infringement. You're out of court.
You're not out of court because of the threat of the assertion of the patent, because you want to market the generic during the lifetime of the patent. And you're certifying to the generic and, I'm sorry, to the brand and to the FDA that the patent either is invalid or will not be infringed. That's very important.
In other words, infringement on the merits is to be decided separately from the fact that, as a matter of law, the filing of the ANDA creates jurisdiction for the issue to be considered.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The court, starting in Glaxo and in a whole series of cases, has rejected the idea that by filing the Paragraph 4 certification, you are agreeing that infringement would result, that there's even a conclusive or even a rebuttable presumption. The court has rejected that roundly.
That's clear from the statute.
It is clear from the statute. You couldn't have a certification of non-infringement under Paragraph 4 if by certifying you were acceding to infringement. And so I think the question on these facts really goes back to Judge Prost's point that this is an if patent, and nothing in the specification of the ANDA tells the court whether that if condition will ever be satisfied. Now in Vanda, that's, the patent is different because what the labeling in Vanda tells the doctor is that in all cases, you should figure out whether your patient is a poor metabolizer or not. You can't determine the correct dosage without doing that genotyping test first. And so in all cases, the labeling the district court found directed performing the genotyping test. This court found that that finding was not clearly erroneous, but it treated it specifically as a fact question. And I think that that is the right way of approaching it. And I think my friends on the other side haven't really dealt with the finding of fact on its own terms. They want the court to look past this evidence and say that the ANDA is conclusive. But when you look at the evidence on which the district court relied, not only is there a complete absence of evidence that these drugs were prescribed together to the same patient, that of course is not dispositive, but it is permissible for a finder of fact to draw an inference from that, especially when you combine it with what the experts said about the warnings in paragraph 7.1 of the labeling, that because of the warnings and because of the availability of another alternative that doesn't raise the same risk with fluvoxamine, and the fact that the person who's going to be prescribing this drug is a pulmonologist. Pulmonologists, that our expert testified and the district court credited, is not going to take someone off of their psychiatric medication when they can instead prescribe a different treatment for their IPF. And that here is OFEV, which is a non-infringing alternative. That's what the district court found as a fact would happen. And I think that factual finding is not clear error and the ANDA doesn't override the evidence about the real world, I think that really is dispositive on the DDI patents.
I have another policy problem. And that is, here this patentee put this system of withdrawal and so on and retitration through clinical trials, all three phases. We know it's expensive, whatever it is. And you're telling us, never mind, that's not patentable. You can't control it. That's a gift to the public. You can't recover your investment in this development, although the FDA requires that it be on the label. Therefore, we're required to put it on the label. Therefore, we cross this bridge that I was concerned with of getting into court to challenge validity and infringement. Why would any of this take place on the position that you now tell us is required? And who's the loser? The patient. The patient isn't going to have the benefit of phase three or the trials and the experience. So who wins? Nobody.
So we disagree with that, and we certainly don't dispute the value of innovative medicines and the clinical trials that underlie them. But this patent and this labeling indication are somewhat unusual for a couple of reasons. One thing I want to point the court to is the fact that the FDA directs using fluvoxamine as a stand-in for a whole class of inhibitors of the same type, CYP1A2 inhibitors. And the evidence in the record is that, and this is at 7342-43, that FDA this is the only one in this class that FDA recommends using in a clinical trial, but it does so as a stand-in for the entire class. That is why if you look in the labeling, you will see that each time fluvoxamine is mentioned, it is prefaced with EG fluvoxamine. This is just one example. But their patent is only on that one, only on the administration of that one specific compound.
Is it also your point that pirfenidone for IPF, this patent did not claim the first use and discovery of that treatment? That was in the prior art.
It certainly was, and these are very narrow method claims. Well into the lifetime of this compound.
They just changed the dosage and then recited lowering the dose if there were side effects and then manipulating, and this is sort of within the skill of the art. The trial court said this was standard medical practice.
Right. And that's exactly right. And now there is this language in the label that they've gotten a patent on. And my friend on the other side said that you should infer intent to infringe, and indeed you should infer that direct infringement will occur, and that if Sandoz didn't like that, Sandoz should talk to the FDA. But of course, the generic's duty in a Hatch-Waxman case is to replicate the brand's labeling verbatim. The duty of sameness obliges it to do that.
How old was the use of pirfenidone to treat IPF?
It certainly before the priority date of these patents. That's right, because the product was being used for that purpose in Japan. That's Perespa, the prior product, whose label is in the prior art. The only other point I wanted to make, which is on the other topic that my friend covered in the top side of the argument, is about the obviousness of the LFT patents. And I really just want to make one point, which is that even in addition to the Azuma reference and the Perespa label, the district court made an important finding about the common medical knowledge at the time, and in particular the HHS guidelines for drug-induced liver injury. And you will find that finding at page 826. Which explains why, even if you took both of the references off the table, the state of the art was that grade 2 liver levels, elevated at the grade 2 level, was not serious enough to definitively require withholding what might be a very important treatment. And the FDA, the HHS guidance, says to medical professionals, to consider continuing to administer, perhaps at a reduced dosage, perhaps at the original dosage. And that's exactly what the supposed innovation is here. The district court's findings on that and on the scope and content of the prior art, Azuma and the Perespa label, were not clearly erroneous. Unless the court has any further questions about anything else in the case, we're prepared to submit our case.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Your Honor, it is true that pirfenidone was available in Japan before Genentech did the work that led to the patents in suit, but FDA had refused to approve it in the United States, and it was not available to patients because of concerns about safety and efficacy.
Approximately how many patents are out there or have been issued related to this drug?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I know that it was an old composition. And
so that long ago expired.
It was not being used to treat patients for IPF because it had not been determined to be safe and effective. And Genentech did the work to establish that it could be prescribed safely for IPF and was then able to bring this therapy to market. Now, I want to start with Vanda. It is true that there was a factual question in Vanda. The factual question was whether the label encouraged genotyping, because the label did not specifically call out genotyping. It simply talked about the possibility of testing generally. And there was a factual question as to whether that would direct a physician to genotype that was resolved in the plaintiff's favor as a factual question. But that does not mean that the question of what force the ANDA label has in an ANDA case is not a legal question, and it is. And in Vanda, this court was very clear. We did not have the burden to come forward with an instance of past infringement, and no particular quantum of infringement is required, such that even an individual patient would be sufficient. Now, there was ample evidence in the record that fluvoxamine is prescribed for depression and anxiety and a variety of disorders. And there was not a suggestion that it's not widely prescribed. The actual testimony in the record, and this is at Appendix 71, 46 to 47, is that the individual physicians who testified as experts for both sides had not seen a patient who had been prescribed fluvoxamine, but observed that they had only seen 0.2% of patients who had presented with IPF during the relevant period of time. So this was a tiny, tiny sample. The district court nevertheless criticized Genentech and said the information that it proffered about the fact that fluvoxamine was widely prescribed and the fact that it was going to potentially be used widely as a treatment for COVID does nothing to lessen the persuasive impact of plaintiff's inability to cite a single example of a patient being prescribed both pirfenidone and fluvoxamine. Evidence was not adduced because it was not our burden to adduce it, because Vanda was very clear that we did not have that burden. And the district court erred as a matter of law in finding that we had not met our burden because we had failed to provide that evidence. Vanda says we don't need it. There is no quantum of infringement that is required. And the district court speculation that instead a physician might prescribe this alternative treatment, OFEV, I would suggest would be clear error, because the same expert who mentioned that possibility also testified that the treatment modality is determined by side effects, which are different between the two different treatment regimes, and price. And in this situation, OFEV would cost $100,000 a year, and pirfenidone would be generic. Nobody testified that in that circumstance, a physician would always choose OFEV at $100,000 rather than discontinuing fluvoxamine, which is one of many drugs that are available to treat depression and anxiety. So again, I would return to the predicate point, Your Honor, that we think this court's jurisprudence has been clear that, yes, the applicant in some circumstances must copy the label language, but the applicant also has the option to go back to FDA and seek a carve-out of that language if it thinks that language is not important, and make its argument to FDA for why that language would not have any real-world impact. Sandoz could have done that here. It made the election not to do that. And it made the election to include these unambiguous instructions in its label. And in that circumstance, we think that Sunovion and Parpharma and this court's precedents mean that where the label is explicit on the question of infringement and directs a physician unambiguously to infringe, that the applicant cannot avoid the force of the instructions that it is given by saying, as the applicant tried to do in Sunovion, well, it's never going to really happen, but instead must be bound by those representations that it made in order to be able to bring a generic product to market.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken under submission. That concludes this panel's argued cases for this morning.